This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. Health officials like to remind people that in these days of jet aircraft, a new virus can spread around the world in days. To computer security people, that's nothing. One wayward mouse click and a computer virus can spread around the world in seconds. You don't have to be a computer expert to disseminate a dangerous computer virus or worm, just the opposite. The best spreaders are innocent, uninitiated home computer users. In our offices, there are IT departments that work to safeguard our computer networks, but at home, it's all up to the individual. People now use their home computers to do research online, bank online, shop online, but many don't take the time to make sure their computers are safe. And if you use email, and nowadays who doesn't, you can play a part in spreading a virus that can crash computers around the world. Everyone knows before you take a car out for a spin you should learn to drive. What knowledge do you need to safely operate a computer? What can you do to make sure you're not a menace to yourself or others? Join the conversation. This is your chance to get all of those dumb questions out there. What have you always not quite understood about your computer but were too embarrassed to ask? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. But before we get to that question, we're going to talk with Lee Rainey. He's the director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project, and he joins us in Studio 3A right here. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Joe.
And the question I want to put to you is, are we more or less comfortable with computers today than we were, say, 10 years ago or 5 years ago even?
Many more people are using computers today than 5 or 10 years ago, and the people who are latecomers, the people who didn't join the party in the early days, are probably not nearly as comfortable as the people who adopted the technology early. That's a classic story about technology adoption that doesn't just apply to computers, it applies to telephones and televisions, but it's definitely true about computers too.
Were people as fast to come to computers as they were to telephones, since you mentioned it?
Yes, actually, the adoption of the computer was somewhat faster.
Really? So there's a gross generalization that anyone over a certain age is comfortable with a computer and that kids are great with them. Is that still true?
It's more or less true, but there's great variance inside those cohorts. People who have a lot of education and a lot of money tend to know a lot more than people who don't have as much education and as many resources available to them. But kids are very comfortable with the technology. Older Americans are not nearly so, and they're much more wary of it.
Wary why?
Because they've heard bad things. Computers are pretty fragile machines and they don't have good reputations for handling all the tasks that we asked of them to do. The online world, too, the internet world, doesn't have a very good reputation with older Americans. They hear about the fraud, they hear about the problems with the technology, they hear about pedophiles and pornography, and they wonder why in the world they would want that in their homes.
But there must be things that are attractive and interesting, too, because just to make it personal, my mother is very fond of going to art galleries and tracking down pieces of artwork using the Internet.
The older Americans who have adopted Internet technology love it. They love the communications features. They love getting pictures from their grandkids. They love exchanging emails and even sometimes instant messages with kids. But by and large, they're more wary, and they are not as confident that they can master the technology as younger Americans do.
When I started the program, I talked about the ease with which the unwary user can send a virus zipping off to somebody else. Would you say that older people are more or less susceptible to causing problems than younger people, or can you break it down that way?
There are two kinds of susceptibility. One is not knowing what is going on, and older Americans fall into that category more than younger Americans do. They're much more likely to leave their email accounts in vulnerable positions. They're much more likely to open emails that they shouldn't. And so that's one problem. But the other problem that younger Americans show to a greater degree than older Americans is they are fearless. And they do things willy-nilly, confident that they can stay on top of things. And in many cases, that's what's creating the problem.
So what is it that determines how comfortable someone is on the computer? Is it just the number of years of experience, or is it is there some other factor?
That's often a big indicator, how much time you spend online and how much you know about what's under the hood in the technology. But another big factor is whether you can rely on someone relatively close in your life, another family member, a close friend, who can get you out of the jams that everybody gets into.
What about you? Are you a tech comfortable or uncomfortable person?
I would fall probably a little bit more towards the comfortable range, but there are things that I do that sometimes I shake my head, and even as much as I know, I'm saying, why did you do that?
Okay, thanks for joining us. Lee Rainey is the director of the Pew Internet and American Life Project. He joined us in Studio 3A. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be here, Joe.
All right, and now that we know who's in the know, we could all use a little help when it comes to our home computer. We could all use a little help, that is, and we're joined by Lori Craner. She's an associate research professor at Carnegie Mellon University and the author of Web Privacy with P3P. She joins us from member station WQED in Pittsburgh. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Okay, so I better get you to start by telling me what P3P is, because that's going to bother me if I don't know.
Okay, well, P3P is the Platform for Privacy Preferences, and basically it's a web standard that allows websites to take their privacy policies and to encode them in a computer-readable language. And once they've done that, your web browser can actually read the privacy policy for you, so you don't have to read all that long legalese at websites.
Okay, all right. Thank you. I really wouldn't have been able to talk to you without knowing what your book title
now
stood
you know.
For. Okay. But let's begin at the beginning. Conceptually, what are the bare basics that users need to know about what's on their home computer? Stand by. We seem to be having some trouble with, we have a phone line that's
yes.
coming. Hey, Sam, one moment. Okay, we're going to have to take a call while we work on the technical problem with our connection to Pittsburgh. So let's take one of your calls. I'm sorry, Chip, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. My question is that why don't the people that give your operating systems, like Microsoft, also make a free download for firewalls or spyware or adware or stuff that might be able to help you fight some of the viruses, like Norton, where you don't have to buy it. If they're concerned about your spreading the virus, maybe back to their computers, why wouldn't they offer it for free?
Well, I think part of the answer to that, and of course, we'll wait. We're trying to get Lori Craner back on the line so that she can give a more expert answer. But I know that the operating systems do provide some level of attention, but I think that some of the message for them is to say, look, we'll keep our computer safe. You learn to operate the computer that you're using in a safe fashion. And what that means is don't open strange emails that you don't know who they came from, or don't open attachments for emails that might contain bugs or viruses. But I think your point is a good one. It certainly is in everybody's best interest to have some kind of protection. What kind of computer are you using right now?
I have just a standard PC, a compact, but I know I spent the money, so I do have a Norton antivirus that upgrades automatically when I turn my computer on. So I imagine as a new virus comes, maybe in the morning a solution comes to my computer in the afternoon. But if somebody doesn't know that, or their regular home system without spending the $40 or $60 for the software might not have access, and it only, like you're saying, it's a community thing. It hurts all of us. So you would think that the community would also get together and say, okay, if you don't know about it or you don't have the $40, Microsoft or whomever is going to send you a message saying this is an important update you need to protect yourself and to protect the community.
Okay. Chip, thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Bill in Tallahassee, Florida. Bill, you're on the air with Talk of the Nation. Oh, push the button. Push the button. Are you there, Bill?
Yeah, hi. How are you?
Everybody's having technical problems today. All I had to do was push the button. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been an administrator for 10 years.
What kind of administrator?
Network.
Oh, okay.
I build them. Well, I also, I'm an administrator of an independent dormitory in Tallahassee. And these kids, it's the spyware now mostly that are affecting the computers and where they're coming in from, the ports that are open, and they don't know, you know.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain what spyware is and what it does?
In layman's terms, like Kazaa, for instance, all right?
Kazaa, okay. What's that?
It's the peer-to-peer music sharing.
Uh-oh, so this is the peer-to-peer, this is the stuff where kids go and download, or anybody goes and downloads music programs, music.
Right, well, there's tons of sites, but you can download music with a program in it that sets itself up in your computer. It's an executable, and it can copy keystrokes, send it back to another website. Personally, I use Norton Antivirus. And I also scan from a site on the web for free because Norton does not pick up every virus that's out there.
Yeah. I'm just curious, though, as an expert, presumably, Bill, have you yourself ever gotten in trouble and had a virus corrupt your system?
Well, I do because I have, like, three machines. One machine I use to test programs, download things. If I'm redoing a computer, I transfer the hard drive over to a folder on my network, and I'll scan it. I don't run into that much trouble.
Okay. Well,
Google has an excellent free pop-up blocker.
Uh-huh. What was the name of that again? I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
At Google.
Google.
The search engine, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, it's getting worse and worse. There's a site, NW Fusion. It's also a magazine that has a whole article on spyware, and it's actually becoming more prevalent than the viruses.
Okay, Bill, thanks very much for your call. I'm happy to say that we've got Lori Craner back on the line from the University of Carnegie Mellon. I'm sorry, are you at Carnegie Mellon or the University of Pittsburgh, or both?
Carnegie Mellon.
Okay, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Well, thank you. I guess technology can bite you anywhere around here. But before we go all the way to spyware, which is what we were just talking about, we were talking about some of the basics. So what are the basics for the home user in terms of protecting himself and understanding what they're dealing with?
Right. So I think the very basic is a person needs to understand how files are stored on their computer, that we have these concepts of files and folders, and that there are programs that you can use to open files. I mean, that's a very basic level, but that's a concept that new computer users don't really understand, and so that's something they need to understand. I think they also need to understand what the Internet is and when they're doing things that are happening on their computer and when they're going out to the Internet, where that line is. And I think that's also very fuzzy for a lot of new computer users.
Is there a way? I mean, it seems to me that one of the things Microsoft and Windows has done is they've tried their best to make it to blur that line between whether you're on the Internet or whether you're not on the Internet. Is there a way that a home user can tell that easily?
No, it's very difficult. I think there are some cues that they may be able to learn with their particular software. So, for example, if you're using the Internet Explorer web browser and you look at the address line that tells you what website you're visiting, if it starts with HTTP, it's probably going out on the Internet, whereas if it starts with file, it's probably on your local computer. So there are things like that people can learn about. But there are a lot of programs that you use, like, say, a word processor that normally runs on your computer, and then all of a sudden you'll do something like ask it to put some clip art in your Word document, and it goes out onto the Internet, and a lot of users aren't aware that that's what's happening.
Well, I guess if you're lucky to be stuck in the old ages where you still have to dial up the Internet, at least you have that kind of a cue to go to.
Certainly. You hear your phone dialing.
You know you're going somewhere.
That's right.
Well, we have to take a short break. We're talking about what's on your computer and how to be a smarter user at home, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. You can send us email. The address is TOTN@npr.org. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palka in Washington. We're talking about computer smarts and safety. You're invited to join the discussion. What have you never quite understood about your computer and the Internet? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org, and we're talking with Lori Kraner. She's an associate research professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. We were talking about, we've just finished discussing how you know if you're on the Internet, and the best way is to cross your fingers, it seems, at least at some level. Let's talk a little bit about what else you need to know. What are some of the basic terminology that a new user should master before going too far?
Well, there are a number of things that are important to know. I think one really important thing before we even get to the Internet is about saving your work on a computer. Mm. I mean, how many of us have known people or even done it ourselves where we've spent hours working on something on the computer and then all of a sudden the power goes out or somebody pulls out the power cord or something, the computer just crashes and you've lost everything. Mm. And I think that happens to a lot of new computer users. Once it happens once, most of us say, oh my, what can we do about this? And we start getting in the habit of pressing that save button very frequently.
Right.
So that's one thing. And then related to that is that if you're editing important files on your computer, whether it's documents that you're writing or your financial records or whatever, you want to have some way of backing them up so that if your computer crashes and you are not able to access the files on your computer, there's somewhere else that they're stored.
You know, I wonder if we're already into a lingo here, because I'm perfectly common. I've been using computers for, 25 years, but you talk about files and backing up, and I say, of course, files and backing up. But does the new user understand what a file is or what it means to back something up? I mean, do people come into the computer world at this junction with that
little amount of, they do know now. No, I don't think they do.
Oh, they don't. Okay.
No. In fact, my grandmother uses a computer, and I'm very proud of her. She's done great things with her computer. But I remember the first time she was trying to send an email attachment. She didn't know that that's what she wanted to do. She said, "Well, I have this photo, and I would like to send somebody a photo. Can I do that with email?" And I said, sure, and I stepped her through how she could do that, and then she did it. And then she said, well, I'd like to send somebody a word processor file. Is that even possible?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, it's the same way you sent them a photo. But she had no concept that these things were both files and you could follow the same procedure.
Well, let's hear what some of our listeners have come up against in what they've been up to. Let's go to Chris in Virginia Beach. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey. Oh, thanks. How's it going, Joe?
Good.
Hey, I think you've brought up some excellent points, as has Professor Kraner. Also, you had a caller a little while ago. I think his name was Bill.
Yeah.
I've experienced the same kind of problems where I'd like to think of myself as an expert computer user, and I actually have several different computers, and one of them is just a junk computer where I have free reign over the Internet. I have antivirus software, but I don't put up firewall software. And it honestly does not take very long before this computer just gets filled with spyware and viruses. It's very, very easy to pick these things up. And I honestly keep a backup, something called an image of my hard drive, and transfer all the files back over just to keep a clean version of the system software. People don't understand that cyberspace and the Internet is actually just as dangerous, if not more so, as far as the kind of nasty stuff you can pick up as in the real world. And we don't protect our children well enough. Microsoft doesn't have any interest in protecting their operating system more closely. So that's one of the reasons why there really is no change, or where it's been very slow. And people do kind of shy away from computers for that reason.
Well, Professor Kraner, what do you make of Chris's point there?
The Internet is very dangerous, and a lot of people are not aware of how they would even start to protect themselves. I think there's some hope that things will get better. I know that Microsoft, everybody loves to criticize Microsoft, but in the past year they have really stepped up their efforts to try to improve the security of their systems. And the change won't happen overnight, but hopefully over time these things will happen. But yes, I think people do need to learn about how they can protect themselves. The first thing is anybody who has their computer connected to the Internet, if you're going to go start downloading things, you need to have a virus checking software on your computer and keep it updated at all times.
Okay, Chris, thanks for the call. Let's go to Hugh in New Vern, North Carolina. Hugh, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm thinking about buying a new computer, and I tend to get kind of overwhelmed if you look at the typical catalogs and Internet sites. You know, you can go from $500 to $800 to $1,200 to $1,800 real quick. And I guess my basic question is it best to buy a cheap computer and upgrade as you need it, or are you better... Do you get a better motherboard and quality by buying something more expensive to begin with?
The age-old question. Dr. Craner, how do you advise people at this point?
Well, it depends on what you think you're going to be doing with the computer. For most home users, I don't think it's necessary for you to get a really expensive computer. I would go with something relatively inexpensive on the motherboard. I would spend your money on getting a monitor that's going to be easy on your eyes. You're going to be able to see pretty well. And not go for a really expensive computer, unless you know that you're going to be running programs that are going to need that kind of processing power. Like if you know that you're going to do, say, video editing, that's something that it would be beneficial to have a more powerful computer if that's what you want to do.
What are you going to do, Hugh?
Well, I got a kid that likes to play games. That's my main thing. I think I need a fairly good graphics board and... But other than that, I'm more concerned about the reliability of the machine. Am I going to have reliability problems if I go cheap?
No, I think for the most part, even the less expensive computers are not going to be very different in their reliability than the more expensive computers.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Hugh. You know, it seems the one other thing that Hugh might want to think about as he goes about this process, as I read, is that the gamers are the most hardware and power mad people out there, because the new games, I put on a copy of Microsoft's Flight Simulator on a new version that they sent me to test, and it took all the muscle my computer had to just run the thing. I mean, these new games are really intensive computer users.
Yeah, so some of the new games really, really do max out everything you have on your computer. So it depends, he didn't say how old his kids were, what kind of games they wanted
to
play.
Right. What about the question of hardware? I mean, is there a problem, things have been moving so fast. What is the cycle if you buy a computer today? How long can you reasonably expect it to operate the software that's being sold, or are you going to be stuck in 2 or 3 years having to buy a whole new computer?
I guess it depends, again, on what you're going to use it for. If you're just using it for email, to browse the Internet, to type up some letters, that sort of thing at home, I think if you buy a computer today, you could expect to continue using it for 5 or 6 years. On the other hand, if you are doing a lot of business applications where you're exchanging files with other people who are always going to be using the latest applications, so you have to have the latest software as well, then it's not going to last quite as long.
Well, all right. I have to say I'm about on a 3-year cycle, but I don't know if that's just because I feel like I need to or because I really have to, but that's another question. We'd like you to join our conversation. The number is 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. And let's go to Denise in Overland Park, Kansas. Is that right, Denise?
Yes.
Oh, well, welcome to the program. What's your question?
Joe. Hi. I have a quick question, and I'll hang up and listen to the answer.
Okay.
I'm a Macintosh user and have been for 15 years. Really have never worried about viruses, these viruses that go around and knock down systems all over and make the news, have never affected me. In the last probably 4 to 6 weeks, I have started getting files, spam files, things that we believe that perhaps I am starting to get some effect from some of these viruses. I have always felt like the people who write the viruses write them for PCs. Is that changing? Are they writing viruses that now affect a Mac operating system?
Interesting question, Denise. What about it, Dr. Craner?
That's a good question. I can't say that I'm an expert on viruses or particularly which operating systems they affect. I currently have a Mac as well, and I do have virus checking software on my Mac, but I have never actually had it catch a virus or tell me that it's found a virus on my system. I think some of the other things you have to worry about is if you are running Microsoft software on your Mac, for example, if you're running word processing or mail software on your Mac, then I believe you'll also be somewhat susceptible to some of those viruses as well.
I want to ask a Philip. Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. In my experience, Mac users are very I don't want to say supercilious, but they sometimes are very proud of their reputation as being virus free. But I know someday they'll get it. Anyway, my other question before we go on to callers is, you know, I know that when you hit the save button, you're actually writing a file to a disk and that there's a change in the physical structure of the disk that makes the file actually exist there. But how much do people really need to know about the hardware of their computer in order to operate it?
I don't think it's that important that they know about the hardware as much as the software, I think is more important to know about.
Okay. All right. Let's go to Chris in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Chris, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I got a dozen questions, but I know I only got time for maybe one or two. The first one is about I'm working with a Mac OS as well, and I'm receiving emails from people that I've never sent emails to. Like lately, it's just gobs of emails from people that I've never sent emails to that are replying to emails that somehow got my email address.
What might explain that, Dr. Cranium?
So probably this is related to a virus, and not a virus on your computer, but a virus on somebody else's computer. There are viruses that will go through somebody's address book and take all the email addresses and then forge mails from those email addresses. And so what might happen is that your email address is in a friend's address book. They get a virus. The virus forges an email that looks like it's coming from you to somebody you don't know, and then their computer responds. And so you get these emails from somebody you don't know. That's one scenario, and there are a variety of variations on that. But this is becoming more and more problematic.
And Chris, you said you had a second question?
Well, yeah, I was wondering, going back to that first question, is there any thing that I can do to sort of remedy that situation?
And no. No, there's not much you can do.
Okay. My second question is about maybe something that you don't have much experience with, but when I Google my phone number, I can get, like, my address and lots of personal information, and I was wondering if you know of any way people might protect, people concerned with privacy issues might protect themselves.
That's a good question. So there are a variety of different ways that your personal information can end up on the Internet. Some of it is coming from phone directories, and most of the online phone directories do have a way that you can remove yourself from appearing there, and you have to basically go and visit all of them and ask that you be removed. Go to the Google directory and the Yahoo directory in each of those. The other way that information ends up on the Internet is if you have a personal web page or your employer has a web page or you've participated in online discussions that are archived on the Internet, and the Google goes and finds all of these sites and collects all of this information, which then people can search.
Okay, Chris, thank you very much for the call. I need to remind people that they're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. To help us understand how vulnerable our computers are now, we're joined by computer security specialist Bruce Schneier. He's the chief technology officer with Counterpane Systems and author of Beyond Fear, Thinking Sensibly About Security in an Uncertain World. He joins us from the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. Are you waiting for a flight there?
I'm waiting for a flight. It's fogged in, though.
Well, that's what most people do at Dallas, I think, is wait for planes, at least at the airport. Thank you for joining us. So we've been talking about the kinds of threats that the Internet poses. People are excited about using the Internet, but are they too trusting, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. The previous caller made a really interesting point, and he's asking about what he can do about things that are out of his control. One of the biggest fears of the Internet and the worries is that much of the security is out of your control. That caller was having email sent from some third party in his name. That caller was worried that third parties had his information and put it out on the Internet. and he's wondering, what can I do? In a lot of cases, you can't do anything. It's I always think of it as the Wild West. It's a lawless society, and if you're a big company, you can afford to hire guards and build walls and live in a fortress. But if you're a farmer, a peasant, you're kind of at the mercy of the forces around you. Largely, you're safe, but sometimes you're not.
Okay. What about, we've been talking with people who need to know, need to learn how to be a smarter computer user. What kinds of things should be people be conscious of when they're trying to improve their own security?
Well, the biggest advice I can give anybody is backup. Backup, backup, backup. The unexpected happens, whether by malice or by accident, and if you don't back up, you lose data. That is the number one security thing you can do, is to back up.
Uh-huh.
Number two is to get some kind of antivirus software. The viruses are nasty. They can attack hundreds of thousands of people in minutes. And if you have antivirus software, you're largely immune from this kind of stuff. So it means all those things that hit the paper, you're probably not going to get. Those two things are I think, the most important. The third thing is to be careful. A lot of things are out of your control. There are scams. There's lots of... there's innocent-looking email from your bank or from PayPal trying to entice you to give someone your account number who's going to steal money from you. And being very cautious and very skeptical when you receive email or visit a web page is really important. Those are the three main pieces of advice. You know, anything else is going to be much more advanced.
Really? What about, people have this problem of that they have lots and lots of passwords. I mean, every time you go to a different site, they pick a password, they pick the same one. They have 50 different sites. You figure out one password, you're into all of them. What can you do about that?
I'll give you a piece of advice. I had that problem, and I actually wrote a free piece of software that solves it. It's called Password Safe. You can get it on Schneier.com. You can get it on any of the free software sites out on the Internet. And it basically is a password manager. It stores your passwords securely so you don't have to remember them. Because I agree, that's an enormous problem. I probably have 50 of those passwords, and I can't remember them all. And one alternative is to choose the same password for everybody. That's not a good idea. The other one is to write them down by your computer. That's an okay idea, but not a great idea. So I wrote a program that lets people store them. And I think that's the good solution. That's what I use.
We only have a few seconds before the break, but what about this thing called Passport that people were trying to give you, where you put your computer, your password in one place, and then it's saved somewhere, and it's all, you don't ever have to give it again?
I didn't use it. It was a Microsoft product. There was a lot of marketing behind it. There was a lot of, we're going to do what's best for you because we think so behind it. I didn't trust the system. I didn't trust the way it was working. Passport really hasn't taken off. Because a lot of people are mistrusting of Microsoft. Why should Microsoft control all your passwords? You need to control them.
All right.
So I don't recommend using that. For some users who are...
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to interrupt you because when we come back, we're going to finish up our conversation about how to keep your computer safe at home. And we'll talk with a reporter who's just returned from the world of worm and virus writers. I'm Joe Palca. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. Today we're talking about how to protect the information on your home computer. We're talking with Lori Craner. She's an associate research professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. And Bruce Schneier, he's joined us from the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. He's the author of Beyond Fear, Thinking Sensibly About Security in an Uncertain World. And let's take a call from Mike in Oh, Tempe, Arizona. Mike, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Just a couple of comments. I also work in the computer security field. And two things that people have to realize. Number one, there is generally no such thing as free software. And that you talked about spyware previously. Most of the free stuff that you get, you know, usually has spyware in it. Some of it is innocuous. Some of it is not. The other thing is that a lot of people buy and put in the antivirus software, and they actually do go ahead and update the software, and sometimes automatically, but they don't take the time to either schedule or scan their systems to actually look for viruses that are resident. So they install it, feel pretty good about it, and don't realize that I actually do need to either schedule it or actually do scanning of it. Anyway, I'll go ahead and take my the rest of it off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Bruce Schneier, what about that? You wrote free software. Is it really good? Is it really
it
free?
It works. It's free. Yeah, I mean, there is some free software. He's right that a lot of free software does have a commercial angle. And if you're not paying with money, you're paying with your information. There are exceptions, but in a lot of cases, he's right. And you've got to be careful. Again, be skeptical. You know, I wrote a little application. It's nothing like a major piece of software. It's a small thing that does one job, and I wrote it, and I gave it away. You know, I don't have a commercial angle, but a lot of companies do. His other point is good also. It's really easy to install something and not use it properly. You know, even for big corporations, you know, firewalls are installed not used properly, and antivirus software is installed not used properly. It's not enough to install it. You have to actually use it. Those are two really good points.
Okay. Bruce Schneier, I feel that we have to let you go to catch your flight. Yes, because the last thing you want to do is be stuck in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. So I'll thank you for joining us and let you go.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. And Lori Craner, you're still with us, I hope.
Yes.
Okay. So let's continue our discussion. One of the questions about this security of we've been beguiled by the ease of use of the Internet for buying stuff and banking online. Is it safe if you use it properly and if you are careful about hiding your passwords and keeping your protection of virus protection up to date?
The Internet is safe, but you have to be sensible. And it's just like, is it safe to go walk in downtown New York City? Yes, it's safe if you're careful. And I think people should think about the Internet the same way.
And what about what does being careful mean? I mean, I know what it means to be attacked, at night in a dark alley. But what can happen to you in the computer using that analogy?
So I think the risks are that your computer could get a virus, which could make it make it so you can't use your computer anymore. You could lose some of your data that you're storing on your computer. Some of your personal information could be. Taken away could go where you don't want it to go. Those are some of the major risks. People are also concerned if they have children using their computer that children may get exposed to pornography or other things that their parents don't want them to be exposed to on the Internet. Those are some of the other risks.
We have an email here with a question for you. It says, how can I delete all of the junk that has built up on the hard drive over 6 to 7 years of web surfing and free up some space? It currently takes a very long time to open a single page. And then this is from Eric, who says, I have a 200 megahertz Pentium with regular home dial-up. So how do you free up space and get things to work faster?
Okay, well, it depends on what software you're using, but most web browsers have something that's called a cache, and that's where it stores all the junk on your computer. And so you need to find in your web browser the button that says Clear Cache. And if you haven't done that in a long time, it may take a while. So just be patient. Let your computer work on that. That's one way to do it. The other way is to find where those files are located and delete them. And for that, it may help to find somebody who knows a bit more about your computer and help you do that.
Yeah. How often should you be cleaning out your cache?
It depends how often you use your computer and how much, but every few months at least is a good idea. You can also, depending on what software you use, put a cap on it so that it can't grow too big, and that's another thing that's a good idea. But unfortunately, there's a lot of computer maintenance that you just have to keep doing. I've found that when I used to use Microsoft Windows, I had to reinstall everything on my computer about once a year if I wanted to keep everything in good working order.
Why? Why does that happen? Am I going into the realms of questions you shouldn't ask?
Yeah, I don't know why that is, but I found that there were programs that used to work that would inexplicably stop working, and I could spend a lot of time trying to track down the problem, or I could just reinstall everything. And reinstalling everything takes a long time, but it was less time than I would spend tracking down what the problem was.
I see. The pragmatic user. Okay. Let's take another call. Kennedy in Buffalo, New York, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm pretty much a basic home user where I do email and documents and things like that, and I have a dial-up modem. But I'd like to be able to do more. Like, let's say I wanted to buy a Quicken program and do more home financial things. What's the best way, the easiest way, to sort of get up to speed on what those programs do? Because, you know, they come with these 300-page manuals, and do you have to sit down and read through it all or do the tutorials that come with them? Is that the best way of getting things, you know, getting yourself up to speed on a new program?
So many of them do come with tutorials that are good. You can also usually go to your favorite bookstore and get a book that will be much easier to read than the manual that came with it. So there's the Dummy series is a good series, and there are all sorts of other books. And so if you go to a bookstore and say, what books do you have on Quicken, you'll probably find that there's, you know, 10 different books on the shelf, and look through them and find one that you think is really easy to read and get that one.
Okay.
But
okay,
Kennedy, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
You said that they come with 200-page manuals, but in my experience, just the opposite. They seem to be, the manuals seem to be getting smaller and smaller, and if you want to find something, you have to search online or go to their website.
Yeah, that's true too. Actually, I guess the version I bought several years ago and haven't tackled yet. So now I'm feeling like I need to upgrade my version because it's so old now and obsolete. But yeah, I think the newer ones, it seems like they do have more a lot of online help and web help, and with a dial-up modem that takes a little time for me. But you know, I'm not a big fancy user or anything. So what I'm looking to do, I think, is pretty simple.
Okay. Kennedy, thanks for the call. Dr. Craner, how often do people need, I mean, you talk about reinstalling your operating system once a year, but how often do people need to go out? I mean, for example, the call Kennedy mentioned Quicken. Every year they say they come out with a new version, and they say this one's better and faster and smoother and cheaper or whatever. How often do people need to buy new software for their computer if what they have seems to be working?
Well, it depends what you're doing with it. And if what you have works for you, then don't change it. Stick with what you have, unless you've heard about some new feature in the new software that you think would be really nice to have. But otherwise, yes, keep using what you're using. The people who end up having to upgrade most frequently are people who are sharing their files with other people, and their friends have all upgraded, and so they need to upgrade in order to remain compatible. Or if you're, say, using, say, tax software, well, the tax rules change every year, so you have to get the update every year, things like that.
Okay. Dr. Lori Craner, I want to thank you for joining us today. Lori Craner is an associate research professor at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. She joined us from member station WQED in Pittsburgh. Thanks very much.